My Plan to Begin With, Part 1. I came from dropping out. The only thing I knew at the start was to quit before they could fire me. My mother left college in favor of the counterculture. In the legend of Judith Leatham, it was a brilliant move with no regrets, though I recall her discussing a matchbook offer from Empire State College, which awarded degrees for life experience. Hers would have been for protest, encounter groups, social work, drugs. My father, a Fulbright scholar, studied painting at Columbia and in Paris, but threw over a tenure-track gig for work as a cabinet maker and commercial Manhattan galleries for cooperative Brooklyn ones. You ran away to make a world, vanished into a garret and emerged with pages Prometheanly aflame, thumbed to San Francisco. The Beat Generation script sank into my deep layers, even as I tired, fast, of Kerouac's novels. Your parents are the first memo to come across your desk, on a page so large you can't see past its edges. At least half of the known universe had done without higher education. In the legend of Judith Leatham, which likely only lived in my head, that half was the smart one, our home bookshelves, her word palace. Later, I'd notice how many of the volumes actually had Richard Leatham, Columbia University, jotted on their flyleaves. I still receive congratulations for having, quote, evaded the MFA mill, unlike my generational cohort. At those moments, I really ought to offer a blanket defense of those in the poignant and terrifying situation of trying to become a writer. By whatever means available, the dedication of MFA students often moves me to tears when I speak before them. Instead, I'm usually silent, embarrassed to explain that I was too drunk on a script at least 50 years out of date to even notice what had become the new template for becoming a writer. The system was invisible to me until it was too late. After all, didn't every novelist work as a clerk in a bookstore until they'd published their first book? The Used Bookshop Stories. 1. Opening the Shop. At 15, I graduated from sweeping up the painted wooden floorboards and neatening the stock on the erratic, slapped-together wooden shelves and running to Steve's restaurant for coffee, light, in paper cups with a Parthenon on the side, and for corn muffins scorched on the grill, to opening the shop by myself. Saturdays and Sunday mornings on Atlantic Avenue, in the little bookstore next to Kalfayan Carpets, and across the street from the tire shop, nothing doing here, our eccentric little bookshop was 20 or 30 years too early for gentrification, if it ever stood a chance. Michael didn't really like to get up in the morning, and as the months went by, he liked less and less to preside over the empty store. I was his solution, the local kid who'd be thrilled just to get credit with adults for working when what I was really doing was reading, puttering in the stacks, playing god of books in this almost wholly private realm. I'd take home my pay in books alone, was always gathering a stack of goods in the back corridor that I'd shift into my knapsack when I'd earned them. And inside a glass-fronted case were our rare books, including a couple I coveted and saved months to earn. Henry Miller and Michael Frankel's Hamlet, with a red ribbon binding and uncut pages, and an autographed copy of Bernard Wolfe's mysterious Limbo. I still own the Wolfe, but can't recall where and when I let go of the Miller-Frankel. I'd roll up the gate at 11, having bought myself not coffee but tea and the grilled corn muffin from Steve's, pull the cart of stealable, cheapo books to the sidewalk in front of the window, and plant myself at the old wooden desk to the right of the door, a sentry position against the risk of thievery, waiting for the first customer of the day, sometimes an hour before anyone wandered in. The place had no heat, and in cold months I'd be in scarf and hat, rubbing gloved fingers together, waiting for the sun to hit the window and warm the storefront. We kept change in a cigar box in the top drawer, and the only time I ever left the desk for even a minute, the box was scooped clean by some clever bandit. My fault, but Michael knew thievery was the neighborhood's nature and just shook his head. It counted not against me, but against him sticking around Brooklyn, and soon enough the little shop moved up to a basement storefront on East 84th Street in Manhattan, half the size of the Atlantic Avenue storefront and 100 times more viable. 2. Paloma Picasso. My roommate was the night man at the shop on Broadway and 80th, a high, narrow shop with a central staircase to a rare book level upstairs, and used records in a bin beneath the stairs. I was the night man's backup, closing the place alone on Friday and Sunday nights. The store buzzed between 7 and 10 on weekend nights, full of couples strolling after movies or dinner, the cash register whirring. The last hour, 11 to midnight, was pretty dead, especially on a Sunday. This night, reading, as usual, at the counter, I was alone there, apart from a long-necked beauty in haute couture, who amassed a mighty pile of art and photo books, making several trips up to the counter to drop off her accumulation, then returning to her browsing. I grew mildly curious as the expensive pile swelled, feeling a faint, sexy complicity between us. Then, as in a television commercial famous at the time, she revealed her identity to me wordlessly by paying with a credit card.